Let's begin the Boston Globe for this Friday, the 10th of April, 2026, with the Boston Globe reading on the Talking Information Center. We say hello to Pam and Pamela.
Good morning, this is Pamela.
And this is Pam.
And from the front page, inside Connolly Early's hardest decision of my life, leaving West Point for baseball, Red Sox. Connolly Early, Red Sox rookie, was 8 years old when a family trip to upstate New York offered glimpses into his twin passions and potential life paths. The Earlys are baseball people, which inspired the visit from their native Virginia, Connolly's brother's tournament in Cooperstown, home of the National Baseball Hall of Fame. But the Earlys are military people, too. So while they were in that corner of the country, their matriarch, Mother Anne, decided they may as well see the sights, including the United States Military Academy, a mere 3 hours away in West Point. Young Connolly, enamored by the campus, majestic, and cost to cadets, $0, had seen enough. He asked his parents to buy him a hat from the gift shop. "My parents say," Early recalled, "I was all in on going there." Nearly a decade later, as the concepts of college and adulthood grew more concrete, Early made moves to turn his boyhood dream into reality. He had it all planned out. He would attend West Point, join the Army, and serve his country, continuing in the proud tradition of many generations of Earlys. And yet, here he is, in the major leagues, a bright spot amid an ugly start to the season for the Red Sox, pitching Friday night against the Cardinals in St. Louis. How did that happen? "It was probably the hardest decision of my life, the biggest decision of my life," Early said. "I thought my parents were going to be more on me. You stay here, it's a really good opportunity. But they knew that in the end, I was a grown-up and needed to make my decision on my own." The Earlys of Virginia. For the Earlys, military roots run deep. The newest generation features Connolly's brother, Cable Early, the second of four boys who's in the Air Force and went to the Air Force Academy. Connolly's father, Todd Early, graduated from the Virginia Military Institute and served in the Air Force. His paternal grandfather was in the Navy and stationed on the USS Shangri-La in the early 1960s. His maternal grandfather was in the Army and trained soldiers deploying to Vietnam. The family traces its lineage at least all the way back to Jubal Early, Lieutenant General in the Civil War for the Confederacy. Fort Early in Lynchburg, Virginia, is named in his honor. "I don't think he was the greatest general," Todd Early said. "You can't distance yourself from relatives." Connolly Early added, "Obviously, he didn't grow up in the best time, so it's a little tough sometimes with that. But wait, there's more." According to Hairston.org, a genealogy website focused on Virginia families of the era, Jubal Early's great-grandfather was Jeremiah Early II, a veteran of the American Revolution. Put another way, the Earlys have fought for their country since before there officially was a country to fight for. "It's not something that's front and present all the time," Todd Early said. "It's kind of this thread that weaves through all of that, and we're proud of that." That was the context in which Connolly pursued the West Point admission process, complete with extensive academic testing, a candidate fitness assessment, and a nomination from a local member of Congress. Connolly received two, Todd said. However many people start the application, it ends up being a very small amount who end up actually finishing, Connolly said, and getting in also is another step of it. It was the only college he applied to. The gut-wrenching part. Early arrived on campus during summer 2020, the thick of the pandemic. He was playing baseball as a hobby. The idea of going pro was unrealistic, he said. He attended West Point because he was going to be in the Army. "As a family, we were all in," Todd Early said. "That was a great opportunity for him. We saw the potential for that career path and him to be successful in that." Connolly said, "I had no thought of pro ball. As a freshman, he was a reliever. As a sophomore, he earned a starting spot. He pitched perhaps the game of his life to that point against Southern Miss in the NCAA regionals, but the Black Knights advanced no further. A day after the season ended, Early jumped into a month-long cadet field training, a West Point signature, halfway through the four-year term. They slept in the woods, did obstacle courses and other physical challenges, got trained on tanks, howitzers, mortars, and night vision technology, and pulled patrol," Early said. "That meant staying awake and alert while others are asleep or working, guarding against surprise attacks. It's pretty much to get you just well-versed in all Army things," Early said. You're sleeping in the field for 5 days at a time, no shower, nothing like that. While in the field, Early and his teammates learned their coach, Jim Foster, was leaving for Northwestern. Suddenly, Early faced a major question. Should he stick at West Point under a new coaching staff? Or, off a standout season, should he consider his options? Curious, during a free moment, Connolly entered the transfer portal and included Todd's phone number since he was off the grid. Then the phone started ringing with interest from big-time programs looking to lure him away. It was more overwhelming than Connolly anticipated. It happened real quick, Todd said. If these schools wanted him, it meant he was a prospect. Of the new options, most attractive was the University of Virginia, which was close to home and had a military-esque culture, Connolly said, in its regimented schedule and high expectations. For days, Connolly and the Earlys agonized over it. The gut-wrenching part is, one, you know you're leaving a phenomenal education, so the piece of paper matters. And he'd already invested 2 years in it, through the worst part, Todd said. The guys they played on the team with were kind of his brothers, so those are the parts that were hard. Looking at the opportunity for baseball, that was easy. Ultimately, Connolly decided to pivot away from serving his country and toward the national pastime, the reverse of what so many young Americans had experienced through the decades. It was a very difficult commitment to make, Connolly said, but once I made it, I was like, I gotta be all in on this because I'm leaving something so good behind. Alongside some of your boys. To Connolly, the change wasn't necessarily permanent. He was giving baseball a go, but if it didn't work out, the military still would be there. He even could take an accelerated path, given the partial West Point background. It wound up not mattering. He emerged as a draft candidate during his junior year, his only year at Virginia. The Red Sox took him in the fifth round in 2023. Flying through the minors, Early earned the nickname the Goal Crusher, an attitude that his father said he could be contributed to Connolly's mother. She's the intense one. That could be better. Good job, it could be better. The boys have that mentality of, okay, what's next, Todd said. And knowing if he called Mom and says, hey, I got that, she would say, okay, what's next? In a really good, positive, self-improvement way. So strong was Connolly's spring training that the left-hander opened the season in the Red Sox rotation, which had looked full until he was forced his way in. He's living the life, making good money, flying on private planes, and staying in fancy hotels. The Earlys liked to visit, including in Cincinnati for his season debut, and over the weekend in Boston to help him move into an apartment. Sometimes, Connolly wonders where in life and the world he would have been had he stuck at West Point. He would have graduated 2 years ago and by now probably would have finished Ranger School, regarded as one of the toughest training experiences in the Army. He sounded almost wistful about it, missing memories never created. Staying in touch with buddies from back then, several of them New Englanders who can't believe he's playing for the Red Sox, allows him to live vicariously. They are scattered about in Korea and California, Germany and Georgia, the Middle East and the Southeast. Often, Early is struck by the similarities between his boyhood dream and adulthood reality. He's on a team with a bunch of guys from all over, unified by one big goal, standing by each other, even wading through the muck. The locker room vibes that you have here are similar to what you get in the military, Early said. This is a good group of guys. And even if you're sucking, even if the stuff is sucking, you're alongside some of your boys, so you guys are going to make a good time out of it, somehow. Pam?
Business looking up in Downtown Crossing. Trendy retailers fill long vacant spots. In Downtown Crossing, two trendy retailers are poised to breathe new life into a pair of long vacant eyesores, and business leaders and residents hope into the neighborhood along with it. A new flagship of clothing store, Uniqlo, and the first New England location of an Asian lifestyle store, Tesso Life, are both preparing for their debuts this month, within a block of each other on Washington Street. At 399 Washington, in a space that has sat empty for two decades, passerbys this week peeked into Uniqlo's shop windows at the displays of denims, linen button-downs, and graphic tees ahead of the grand opening on Friday. Across Winter Street, at 459 Washington, a bright orange Coming Soon sign heralds the arrival of Tesso Life, a Queens-based purveyor of Asian toys, home goods, beauty products, and snacks. The two stores, joining other budget-conscious neighbors like Primark and TJ Maxx and Old Navy in the city's stalwart shopping district, reflect an often counted-out neighborhood, learning to play to its strengths. The COVID-19 pandemic wounded the real estate market in the downtown corridor, a key slice of the city's property tax base. But that financial blow ended up giving the neighborhood an edge over pricier enclaves like Back Bay or the Seaport, and courting buzzy brands like Uniqlo and Tesso Life. And those coups, observers said, are helping infuse the whole neighborhood with fresh energy. There's this temptation to talk about the revitalization of the neighborhood. I don't want to overstate it, but it's kind of like we're already there, said Noam Ron of Hudson Group, one of the firms that bought 399 Washington last year. We find ourselves no longer having to sort of apologize for Downtown Crossing. To be sure, downtown is still in recovery mode, with office vacancies well above pre-pandemic levels and foot traffic well below, though both appear to be steadily improving. Retail has been a notable bright spot, with a single-digit number of vacancies on Washington Street between City Hall and Chinatown, according to Michael Nichols, president of the Downtown Boston Alliance. In addition to Uniqlo and Tesso Life, Washington Street, a main downtown artery, is soon slated to welcome a new Skechers store, a hot pot restaurant, and an Italian sandwich shop. The retail vacancy rate in the greater downtown neighborhood was 1.6% in the last quarter of 2025, down a tick from the same quarter in 2019, according to city data. I'm delighted it's come as far and as fast as it has, given where we were 2 years ago, Nichols said. The rebirth of 399 Washington Street is a saga 20 years in the making. Once home to a string of clothing stores stretching back to the 1880s, the space has been without a retail tenant since Barnes & Noble moved out in 2006, unable to negotiate a new lease with its landlord. Out-of-state firms LaSalle Investment Management and L3 Capital purchased the building for $63 million in 2017, undertaking a major renovation as it prepared to court new tenants. Then the pandemic hit, robbing the neighborhood of much of its sought-after foot traffic. That's how, last year, the building ended up in the hands of Boston-based Hudson Group and New York-based Assembly Investments and Time Equities for a cool $13 million, just a fifth of its previous price tag. It was that rock-bottom rate that allowed the new owners to woo a tenant like Uniqlo pretty immediately with an attractive rent price, Ron said. Ron declined to specify what Uniqlo was paying for rent for the 10-year lease, citing confidentiality. People constantly ask about the 20 years of vacancies, but it's not rocket science, he said. We were fortunate enough to buy it at the right time, at the right basis, and we can pass that lower rent along to folks like Uniqlo. The retailer, which specializes in minimalist wares, handled much of the build-out of the 20,000-plus square foot space, but taking care to preserve the brick ceilings, ornate columns, and central staircase linking the two levels. I just feel like bringing it to the area is going to bring a lot of traffic back, said Alvin Spinkston, 29, a passerby who stopped by the almost open store this week, wearing a tan Uniqlo trench coat. Growing up in the Roxbury area, he said he used to go downtown frequently, just not as much anymore. But that will change after opening of the store, he said, which he patronizes often for its great silhouettes. This definitely got my attention, he said, knocking on the store window where mannequins posed in pastel ensembles. From Uniqlo's point of view, 399 Washington Street presented the opportunity to open what Tomo Yasudo, director of real estate for Uniqlo North America, called a key store in Boston, larger than its Newbury Street and since-closed Faneuil Hall outpost, and more central than its other suburban Massachusetts locations. He said a flagship like this one, which will employ about 120 people, has the room to offer a wider selection, plus other services like the Re-Uniqlo Studio, which can repair or recycle customers' old Uniqlo duds or spruce them up with embroidery, and UTMe, a program that partnered with local artists to put their Boston-centric designs on T-shirts and tote bags. It was a perfect mix, said Yasuda of the downtown area, pointing to the blend of office workers, tourists, and students. The people are there, and there's actually big spaces that we can really operate in and show what we have to offer. It was a similar story over at the retail space in 459 Washington Street, which also stood barren for years after the closure of former tenant Forever 21. In 2024, to avoid foreclosure, the property was taken over by the owner's private lender, Mark Samwick, the founding partner of that lender's New York-based parent company, said he connected with Tesso Life within days of putting the approximately 20,000-square-foot three-floor space up at the lease market. "We think this is really, almost essentially, at the corner of Main and Main," he said. "This is where you want to be." Like Uniqlo, securing a tenant like Tesso Life, he said, required a more flexible approach compared with the previous owner. Part of that approach was setting a too-good-to-pass-up asking rent price, $37 per square foot, well below market value. C.Y. Kwok, general manager of Tesso Life, said that the brand has been looking to set up shop in Boston for 3 years, but had never found the perfect site before the Downtown Crossing space opened up. "It has a lot to offer at that location. We were looking at Newbury Street, but that area, it's good, but it's way out of our budget. It's way too expensive in terms of rent." For some consumers, the two retailers are more than just big box stores. "I like how it's getting a lot more Asian representation," said Kenzie Mao, a 20-year-old Suffolk University student of the downtown neighborhood with Uniqlo and Tesso Life moving in. "It makes us have more of a community." Last month, with a 10-year lease secured, Samwick decided it was time to sell the retail space, putting it on the market for $13.7 million. But that wasn't an easy decision. "We thought about this longer and harder than others, because we really think that Downtown Crossing has a very bright future in front of it," Samwick said. "That bright future is likely to come sooner because of the splash Uniqlo and Tesso Life will make," said Whitney Gallivan, senior managing director and partner at Boston Realty Advisors, who helped broker the latest sale of 399 Washington. "When a tenant comes to town, historically they may say to us, 'We only want to look in the Back Bay or in the Seaport.' But if we can say, 'Well, Uniqlo just opened up in Tesso, why don't you look at this block on Washington Street? There may be a spot for you. And plus, you're paying a lot lower rent than you would be in the Back Bay. And that's going to help."
Emperor penguins are declared endangered. An update by Conservation Group also notes Antarctic fur seals are endangered. Emperor penguins, the world's largest and perhaps most recognizable penguin species, have joined the list of wildlife endangered by global warming, the International Union for Conservation of Nature announced Thursday. In an update of its Red List, a comprehensive and authoritative listing of global species based on their extinction risk, the group also said that Antarctic fur seals had moved into the endangered category and that southern elephant seals had moved to vulnerable. In the case of penguins and fur seals, the changes are largely driven by shifts in sea ice levels and food availability linked to global warming, the researchers said. For species in the Antarctic region, this is the first clear evidence of climate change's influence popping up in a big way, said Kit Kovacs, a marine mammal researcher at the Norwegian Polar Institute who leads the IUCN seal project. Scientists know of 66 emperor breeding colonies, exclusively in Antarctica, many of which were only recently revealed by springtime satellite imagery. Images taken between 2009 and 2018 showed an overall population decline of nearly 10%. Another recent study suggested that between 2020 and 2024, 7 colonies in the Ross Sea had declined by 32%. Looking further into the future, various studies predict quasi-extinction in many of the colonies, said Philip Trathon, an emeritus marine ecologist of the British Antarctic Survey, who assisted with the IUCN penguin assessment. The penguin decline largely boiled down to sea ice, which has hit record low levels in the past few years. Emperor penguins rely on sea ice for breeding and to avoid water during their annual molt, when they essentially lose waterproofing and insulation. It also forms habitat for their aquatic prey. The birds will not be able to survive without sea ice, which in turn depends on reducing greenhouse gas emissions, something that needs to happen urgently, Trathon said. In the meantime, he added, protecting the places where emperor penguins breed, molt, and forage could help sustain the species. Zhao Sheng, director of the Polar Research Center at Sun Yat-sen University in China, who is not involved in the IUCN assessment, agreed that much evidence suggests that emperor penguins are experiencing increasing pressure. He added, though, that it's premature to assume the fate of the species is sealed based on relatively short-term satellite observations. While strengthening conservation actions is important, it's also important to carefully evaluate and maintain confidence in the species' resilience, Cheng said. Emperor penguins are capable of diving to 1,750 feet in search of squid, fish, and krill. Males handle egg incubation during the continent's long, dark winter, foregoing food as they huddle together to conserve heat. Before Thursday's update, they had been in the near-threatened category. Once killed by the millions for their soft pelts, Antarctic fur seals quickly rebounded to conservation status of least concern after a hunting ban was adopted in 1972. Since 2014, however, populations have plummeted to fewer than 1 million adults from an estimated 2 million. The magnitude and speed of this decline was surprising, Kovac said. The main reason seems to be a sharp shift in the availability of krill, especially around South Georgia. As water is warm, krill are moving deeper and farther offshore in search of colder temperatures. Krill distribution shifts are unlikely to be reversible, according to Jaume Forcada, a marine mammal scientist at the British Antarctic Survey. A number of other factors might also hasten the decline of fur seals, he added, including increasing levels of commercial krill fishing, competition for krill from recovering whale populations, plastic and other pollution, and disease outbreaks. Southern elephant seals have been moved to vulnerable. The species, previously listed under least concern, has become especially susceptible to bird flu, Kovac said. Since the virus first emerged in southern elephant seals in 2023, it has resulted in overall declines of more than 30%. The high mortality might have been exacerbated by climate change, Kovac said.
Melania Trump denies ties to Epstein in rare White House address, asks to end lies. First Lady Melania Trump is denying ties to Jeffrey Epstein and knowledge of his sex crimes, saying Thursday that the stories are completely false and calling accusations that she was somehow involved smears about me. Reading in an extraordinary statement at the White House, Melania Trump said that she and her attorneys were fighting back against unfound and baseless lies in regard to her connections to the late financier, the convicted sex offender who leveraged connections to the rich and powerful and famous to recruit his victims and cover up his crimes. The lies linking me with the disgraceful Jeffrey Epstein need to end today, she said. The individuals lying about me are devoid of ethical standards, humility, and respect. I do not object to their ignorance, but rather I reject their mean-spirited attempts to defame my reputation. The seemingly out-of-the-blue message came as her husband, President Trump, and his administration had finally seemed to move past more than a year of controversy surrounding Epstein, especially as the Iran war had become all-consuming in Washington. The First Lady's comments almost assuredly served to push the story back into the political spotlight, even as the president urged the public and the media to move on from the case. The White House account on X reshared a video of the event posted by the First Lady's account, but without added comment. The First Lady spoke for about 5 minutes, reading her statement in the grand foyer, then walked away without taking questions. She did not go into detail on the accusations against her, but said they came from individuals and entities looking to cause damage to my good name. She added that they were financially and politically motivated. Melania Trump also called on Congress to hold a public hearing centered on survivors of Epstein's crimes, with a chance to testify before lawmakers and have their stories entered into the congressional record. Each and every woman should have her day to tell her story in public if she wishes. Then and only then we will have the truth. Democrats jumped on Melania Trump's comments, saying that they agreed with her call for a congressional hearing. In a social media post, Representative Robert Garcia, the top Democrat on the House Oversight Committee that is investigating Epstein, called on the Republican chair of the committee, Representative James Comer, to schedule a public hearing immediately. It was not immediately clear what prompted the First Lady to speak out about this issue now. She noted that several individuals and organizations have had to apologize for their lies about me. Of the examples she cited, the most recent was in October. In that case, book publisher HarperCollins UK apologized to the First Lady and retracted passages from a book suggesting Epstein played a role in introducing her and Donald Trump. Melania Trump mentioned her husband several times in her comments. She said Epstein did not introduce her to Trump and that she met her future husband at a New York City party in 1998. Her calls for the issue to go back to Congress came after federal authorities released millions of pages of documents under the Epstein Files Transparency Act, the law enacted after months of public and political pressure that requires the government to open its files on the late financier and his confidant and one-time girlfriend, Ghislaine Maxwell. Lawmakers complained when the Justice Department made only a limited release last month, but officials said more time was needed to review additional documents that were discovered and to ensure no sensitive information about victims were released. Melania Trump said in her statement that she was not friends with Epstein nor Maxwell, but was in overlapping social circles in New York and Florida. She described an email reply she sent to Maxwell as casual correspondence without elaborating. My polite reply to her email doesn't amount to anything more than a trifle, she said. Among the documents released by the Justice Department was a brief email from 2002 with the sender and recipient blacked out. It begins, "Dear G," exclamation point, and ends, "Love, Melania," and compliments the recipient on a magazine article about J.E. "I know you are very busy flying all over the world," it says. "How was Palm Beach? I cannot wait to go down. Give me a call when you are back in New York." That email was sent the same month that a New York Magazine article was published about Epstein, in which Trump called the financier a terrific guy. Among other documents released was an image from Epstein's home, showing a series of photographs along a credenza and in drawers. In that image, inside a drawer, among other photos, was a photograph of Trump alongside Epstein, Melania Trump, and Maxwell.
North Korea tests new weapons. North Korea conducted a series of weapons tests this week that suggest the country is seeking to draw lessons from the war in the Mideast to sharpen its military deterrence against the United States and South Korea. The North Korean military said Thursday that among the weapons tested were missiles carrying cluster munition and graphite bomb payloads, much like weapons that have appeared in the Middle East. Iran has launched missiles with cluster munition warheads at Israel. And a widespread blackout in Tehran, the Iranian capital, last month led to online speculation that graphite bombs may have been used. The Pentagon has not commented. That North Korea is testing similar weapons signals that the country is trying to learn from the Mideast war, much as it has from Russia's war against Ukraine, and that it's incorporating these lessons into its own war plans, military experts said. In tests conducted from Monday through Wednesday, the official North Korean news agency said, North Korea's military demonstrated several advancements in its arsenal. South Korean officials confirmed that North Korea carried out multiple weapons tests this week. A short-range ballistic missile known as the Hwasong-11A, or KN-23, was used to test a cluster bomb warhead and destroy an area equivalent to 10 football fields, the North Korean state media said. A cluster warhead disperses dozens of small bombs across a wide area, inflicting far greater damage than a conventional single explosive payload. North Korea also tested carbon fiber graphite bombs, also known as blackout bombs, which are designed to disable an enemy's electrical grid by setting off extensive short circuits. As part of its ongoing effort to strengthen air defenses against the superior air power of U.S. and South Korean forces, the country tested a mobile short-range anti-aircraft missile system. It also tested the maximum thrust of a new missile engine built with low-cost materials, state media said, reflecting its drive to offset its disadvantages against the United States and South Korea through sheer volume of missiles and rockets. Several short-range ballistic missiles fired during the tests flew between 150 miles and 434 miles off the east coast of North Korea, South Korean officials said. South Korea did not specify which weapons were involved, Bush Presidential National Security Office convened a meeting with top defense officials Wednesday to assess the implications for South Korean security. North Korea has been watching the wars in Ukraine and the Middle East and incorporating key weapon systems used there into its own ability to deter and fight war, said Hong Min, an expert on the North Korean military at the Korea Institute for National Unification, a government-funded think tank in Seoul. North Korea has benefited before from armed conflicts abroad. It has supplied both weapons and soldiers to Russia in support of its war against Ukraine, receiving economic assistance and weapons technology in return, according to South Korean officials and analysts. Last month, North Korea unveiled new tanks equipped with systems to intercept anti-tank missiles and drones, technology South Korean experts suspect came from Russia. The war in Ukraine, the U.S. Director of National Intelligence noted in an annual threat assessment in March, will continue to have spillover effects in other parts of the globe, as shown with North Korean troops gaining valuable warfighting experience in military technology from Russia. North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un, has suspended virtually all diplomacy with Seoul and Washington since the collapse of his nuclear talks with President Trump in 2019. Since then, he has pursued closer ties with Russia and China and doubled down on expanding his military prowess. He traveled to Beijing in September to attend a military parade alongside Xi Jinping, China's leader, and President Vladimir Putin of Russia. China's foreign minister, Wang Yi, arrived in Pyongyang, the North Korean capital, on Thursday for a two-day visit. North Korea's latest round of weapons tests serves multiple purposes, said Yang Mujin, former president of the Seoul-based University of North Korea Studies. They accelerate a five-year program Kim enacted to build up North Korea's defenses and deepen his country's hostility towards South Korea. Kim has long sought to use the threat of instability on the Korean Peninsula as a diplomatic leverage against Washington. Under the five-year plan, which was adopted at a Workers' Party Congress in February, North Korea called for the mass production and deployment of short-range ballistic missiles to greatly increase the density and durability of concentrated attack against South Korea, which it designated as its most hostile enemy state. In a statement Tuesday, Jang Geum-chol, first vice president of North Korea's foreign ministry, called South Korea's leaders world-startling fools for expecting any improvement in inter-Korean relations.
American credibility takes a hit with deal. Some see U.S. power slipping. Historical analogies are never exact, but with the tenuous ceasefire deal and the U.S.-Israeli war against Iran, some are asking whether this is a Suez moment for the United States, marking the waning of American power and credibility in the world. The Suez Crisis took place in October 1956, when Britain, France, and Israel attacked Egypt to force open the Suez Canal. President Dwight D. Eisenhower, with an election days away, ordered them to stop. Prime Minister Anthony Eden of Britain resigned. President Gamal Abdel Nasser of Egypt became a hero of anti-colonialism. Suez became shorthand for the moment that Britain, exhausted from World War II, gave way as a global power to the United States. There are differences from that time. The Suez Canal is human-made and wholly in Egyptian territory, unlike the international waterway of the Strait of Hormuz. There is no other global power capable of replacing the U.S. in the region, let alone ordering President Trump around. But the two-week ceasefire leaves the Islamic Republic in place and still in command of the future of the Strait of Hormuz, with Iran's nuclear stockpile and ballistic missile program unresolved. After Trump's declaration of victory, however hollow, it is difficult to imagine a resumption of full-scale war. For the rest of the world, the war is starting to look like a military defeat, more serious than Iraq or Afghanistan, said Bruno Macais, former Secretary of State for European Affairs for Portugal. The myth of America as all-powerful is important, he added, and it's the basic requirement of a global hegemon to keep the oil flowing, to open up the strait and keep it open. This belief in an all-powerful America that can solve anything is disappearing. Keeping sea lanes open for American goods and global trade is one of the few permanent interests in the United States has in the Middle East, as well as in Asia. The war in Iran shut down the strait, Now the Iranian military is still in control of the passageway and is likely to demand large tolls. The strategic rationale for the American military presence in the region has taken a huge hit, said Stephen Wertheim, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment in Washington. The Suez analogy works, Wertheim said, in that the war in Iran demonstrated in a single incident the danger of American misgovernance and poor judgment. The war itself and its uncertain outcome, he said, just accelerates an existing worry shared by countries around the world about what America's declining quality of governance means for what they can expect from the United States. The United States' allies may be unhappy, perplexed, and even angry about the Trump administration policies, but many of them, especially those in the Persian Gulf and Asia, suffering the impact of energy shortages and restrictions, have few other options for security partners. But the war and ceasefire deal have diminished American influence and will affect how the allies of the United States view its reliability, said Charles A. Kupchan, a political scientist and director of European studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. The war against Iran was not begun in consultation with allies, and it came after a series of events that have confounded them. Trump's tariff wars were an unpleasant shock, but his threat to take Greenland by force if necessary from Denmark, a European and NATO ally, is seen as an inflection point about American predation, unreliability, and contempt for traditional friends. The Iran war and its economic impact are piling on and reinforce the sense that the U.S. right now has become unpredictable and undependable, Kupchan said. International relations and alliances work on trust, but as Francis Fukuyama of Stanford University wrote on Tuesday, there has never been a time when the United States was more distrusted by both traditional friends and by rivals as at the present time.
And from the Metro section, her solo row was a power trip. Two 70-pound batteries, a four-person inflatable raft, a desalinator for making fresh water, and 18 jars of peanut butter were some of Renee Blacken's only companions for more than 2 months as she rowed across the Atlantic Ocean. On Wednesday, the 43-year-old Bethlehem, New Hampshire resident triumphantly returned home, complete with an ambulance escort and cheering neighbors, capping a 3,200-mile rowing journey. She took off from Lanzarote in the Canary Islands on January 24th and landed in Antigua in the Caribbean on March 30th. This is absolutely the longest, wildest, most remote thing I've ever done, Blacken said. Her solo trip, part of the endurance event Atlantic Dash, which launched roughly a dozen rowing crews across the Atlantic this winter, makes Blacken the fourth American woman in history to make such a crossing, said event organizer Billy Taylor. Across the 65 days of the journey, she rowed 12 hours per day in shifts while wolfing down roughly 4,500 calories a day for fuel. Compared to the fatigue and struggle to find her appetite, Blacken said the isolation of the trip was a cinch. There was a lot of time to think, which is why I went out there, she said. I didn't really see another person face to face after I left until I reached Antigua. At night, a parachute anchor, or large canopy projecting underwater from the front of the boat, was used to reduce drag and keep her in place. A two-night rowing expedition was her longest practice run before the event, she said. But you don't hike hundreds of miles to prepare for the Appalachian Trail. You start walking. Her vessel likely weighed over 1,000 pounds, and she built up her strength with regular CrossFit training before launching her boat. Blacken is the president of Outdoor Adventuring for Good, a nonprofit that funds trauma recovery services in northern New Hampshire through feats of sport. Her organization raised $17,000 in donations for various programs from the event, while another $17,000 was raised through a GoFundMe to pay for rowing expenses, she said. Having lived through some traumatic life experiences myself, programs really helped me regain agency on my own healing journey, she said. Those types of services, the farther north you go in New Hampshire, the harder it is to find them. Being out at sea had its own therapeutic effect, she added, especially as it became clear that weather conditions and winds, not her own grit, would determine how fast and far she could travel each day. It was very hard and challenging, but every day there was something that was beautiful. There was something to find joy in, she said. That's a good reminder for everyday life, too. Returning to New England, with a hero's welcome, no less, was a full circle moment for the rower, who spent many hours preparing at Mount Washington CrossFit, a local Lisbon gym, and learned her sport at the Putney School in Vermont before rowing for Bates College in the early 2000s. I've done a lot of adventures solo, but this was just sort of beyond, Blacken said. That was the point, is to really get to that level.
Man killed by police had mental health issues. Family details victim's struggles, calls for release of body cam footage. The man shot and killed by Boston police in Roxbury last month was experiencing a mental health crisis in the hours leading up to the deadly encounter, according to his family and their attorneys. The shooting is one of several recent high-profile mental health episodes that have escalated into violence. The circumstances prompted the family of Stevenson King Jr. on Thursday to call for the immediate release of police body camera footage. Just because you're having a mental health crisis doesn't mean you should be sentenced to death, attorney Ben Crump said at a news conference, the first time King's family has appeared publicly in connection with the case. And that police officer on the side of that street was the judge, the jury, and the executioner. The 39-year-old King had allegedly committed an unarmed carjacking the night of March 11th and was fleeing a traffic stop when Boston police officer Nicholas O'Malley fired his service weapon, killing King. Suffolk prosecutors quickly charged O'Malley with manslaughter, saying he wasn't justified in shooting at the moving vehicle. Several Boston city councilors and community leaders have also called on police to release the body cam footage, but prosecutors and police have resisted, saying that that would jeopardize the ongoing criminal investigation. Crump, a civil rights attorney who also represented the family of George Floyd, said King's mental health declined after his mother died from cancer in 2009. Family members said that they had been trying to get him adequate long-term treatment. They said he would cycle through the criminal justice system, sometimes receiving psychiatric medication while he was incarcerated, only to lose access to regular care after his release. Recently, he was hearing voices and showing signs of intense paranoia, relatives said. Convinced that he was under surveillance, King would put tape over cell phone cameras, electric outlets, and even the emblems on his sneakers. That's how bad it was, said his father, Stevenson King Sr., a retired state corrections officer. That's why I was trying to get some help for my son. Hours before the shooting, King asked his father to call an ambulance because he'd been injured in an assault days earlier. Medics arrived, and they were taking him to the hospital. That's the last time I saw my son, said Stevenson King Sr., his voice strained with emotion. Several family members, including two of King's sisters, addressed the media during the news conference. They displayed a photo of King, smiling widely in a navy sweater and a baseball cap, the way they wanted to remember him. Police had pursued King after he allegedly committed the carjacking outside a pizza restaurant in Mission Hill. About 15 minutes after the reported carjacking, officers stopped the stolen car less than a mile away at Linwood Square in Roxbury. King then ignored verbal commands as officers approached the car on foot, and then he tried to drive away, according to police. A nearby resident who witnessed the shooting told the Globe the situation escalated extremely quickly. According to a police report, King opened the car window at the command of police officers, but did not turn the vehicle off. Positioned outside the driver's side window, O'Malley drew a department-issued taser and shouted, "Bro, I'm going to expletive shoot you," according to the police report. At that moment, King backed into the cruiser behind him, then maneuvered the vehicle forward and back in an attempt to escape the police, according to the report. Even though he wasn't perfect, even though he struggled with mental illnesses, he did not deserve to be killed like this, Crump said. He did not deserve to be killed just because an officer had to rush to judgment. King's family said that they weren't sure what happened after he was transported to the hospital earlier that day. If only his condition had been stabilized before being discharged, said his sister, Ebony King Gibson. He's been in and out of the system for such a long time, battling this thing, battling his demons, she said. When King was arrested in 2024, after police found him asleep in a stairwell with a loaded gun in his sweatshirt, He was drunk and suicidal, Gibson said. He wanted to take his life, she said. King's death adds to the growing list of recent police shootings in Massachusetts that raise questions about whether mental illness played a role. On Saturday afternoon, a man experiencing a mental health crisis was killed by Boston police officer after he attacked first responders with a sword, officials said. He was identified as Jacob Graves, 29, a former student at Berklee College of Music. Police in Weymouth and Westminster also reported deadly officer shootings last month. Attorneys for the King family praised the district attorney's quick decision to charge O'Malley, but leaders of the department's largest union have expressed outrage, saying it's a slap in the face to law enforcement officers risking their lives every day. They pointed to King's criminal history, which includes assault and firearms charges. Also on Thursday, Boston attorney David Yannetti, who recently represented Karen Reed, announced he'd been retained to represent O'Malley. In the Reed case, Yannetti said in a written statement he spent nearly 4 years zealously fighting a district attorney's office that protected bad police officers while prosecuting an innocent woman. Now he plans to zealously fight another district attorney's office that is apparently choosing to protect criminals while prosecuting good police officers, the statement said. Officer Nicholas O'Malley has always maintained a stellar record as a sworn Boston police officer, Yannetti said. He was an exemplary family man, a husband, and a father to young children. He chose to become a police officer for all the right reasons. O'Malley told investigators he fired into the vehicle because he thought another officer was in danger of being run over by King, court records show. Moments later, O'Malley called over his radio that officers were involved in a shooting and the suspect tried to run us over, according to the police report. King was later pronounced dead at the hospital. State law and Boston Police Department policy forbid officers from shooting at a moving vehicle unless there's no other way to prevent imminent harm to a person. Releasing the body cam footage would allow people to see for themselves how the tragedy unfolded, Crump said. He questioned whether the video would have already been made public if it exonerated the officer and implicated King. We shouldn't have two justice systems, Crump said. We should have equal justice for every citizen. Is that so much to ask? Boston City Councilor Menard Culpepper, who had repeatedly raised the issue, called on Police Commissioner Michael Cox to at least let the family view the video. This is about whether Boston is serious about transparency when it matters the most, said Councilor Brian Worrell. You can't have trust in the law without accountability.
At Big Night Live, a free concert for autism awareness. Celebrating Autism Acceptance Month, the Doug Flutie Jr. Foundation brings Stars of the Spectrum, a national concert series performed entirely by autistic artists, to Boston on April 19th at Big Night Live. America's Got Talent winner, Cody Lee, headlines the show, which begins at noon. The three-hour concert is free, with lots of sensory-friendly outlets, fidget toys, noise-canceling headphones, a quiet room to cool down if the music gets too much. All behaviors are welcome. People are free to be themselves without the fear of judgment, said Nick Savarese, the Flutie Foundation's executive director. Brookline's Stefano McCauley, 29, is one of the hometown musicians. He's a pianist, guitarist, and a singer. His favorite artist is Tina Turner, though he's also a fan of local Boston band Wet Pizza. I love pop music, especially, and I'm going to play my own song, Enthusiasm, at the show, he says. Some other people on Stars of the Spectrum have written their own songs about what they sense, things like anxiety, and I go through life with enthusiasm. When he's not playing music, McCauley divides his time between two jobs. He's a guest service rep at the Boston Duck Tours, pointing out landmarks like the city's oldest fire alarm box. It's in the North End. And he also ships pasta for Cambridge's Chitara Pasteria. I wrote the shop's jingle because Chitara is Italian for guitar, he says. His mom, Daniela Caruso McCauley, says the concerts offer a strong sense of community. She wants other parents to feel supported, too, especially early on in the diagnostic process. Every family has their journey. Not everyone is ready for the diagnosis. Not everyone is ready to take that in. That autism makes someone who they are, she says. McCauley was diagnosed at 3. He attended Brookline Public Schools until he was 21, and he now lives at home. At these concerts, he finds his people. I think Flutie's amazing at promoting self-awareness, said accepting the idea of being on the spectrum is something great, and it gets better with time, his mom says. What's special about these concerts is the professional standards, but also there's a sense of familiarity and joy that makes family feel more at ease. We can worry and plan for the practicalities and realities of their adulthood, but we can't cancel joy. Musicians come from around the country, but many are local to Boston. The 28-year-old foundation is named in honor of football player Doug Flutie's adult son. He was diagnosed with childhood disintegrative disorder, CDD, a rare autism spectrum disorder, as a toddler. This annual concert is the foundation's signature musical event. There have been other concerts at Fenway Park and around the country. This version includes 30 musicians, including a choir, with a focus on pop, hip-hop, R&B, and recognizable covers, Savary says. But the main theme is happiness. Autistic people can have amazing lives, says Carusa McCauley. Here, you enjoy the music and good company. You don't think of limitations. Get tickets at www.flutiefoundation.org/stars of the spectrum.
A marathon run powered by love, loss, and community. Everyone who runs the Boston Marathon has a personal reason for wanting to put one foot in front of the other for 26.2 miles, and there's no sugarcoating Jill Hadwin's reason. On June 15, 2025, Joe Pusilowski proposed to her on a beach in North Truro. Their engagement photos show an ecstatic young couple walking through the dunes to a beautiful future together. But on June 19th, Pusilowski, 28, was a passenger in a single-engine plane that crashed shortly after takeoff from Beverly Regional Airport. The pilot was killed. Pusilowski, who was headed to the Adirondacks for a camping trip with friends, was transported to Mass General, where he died a few days later. Hadwin, who was running April 20th as part of the Mass General Boston Marathon team, said she got the crazy idea to run the race as a way to give back for all the compassion and comfort the MGH staff showed during Joe's last days. But she's also running to restore rhythm and a sense of control in her life, as much of a sense of acceptance as she can muster after someone she loved disappeared suddenly and forever. I honestly feel that I let all my anger go when I'm running, she told me in an interview. Her story is also about the power of community. I learned about Hadwin's marathon effort because of our connection through Hinge Fitness, a Melrose gym started in 2019 by Sarah Gudez. The gym specializes in strength training for people of all ages and abilities. Members range from Gen Z to baby boomers like me, but most are in the 45 to 50 age range. I enjoy pre-class chatter about matters that seem like life or death when they are happening, such as a child's middle school woes or anxieties over team tryouts and college admissions, knowing that most will end up as mere blips in the arc of life. But there are life events that are truly life-shattering, like Pusilowski's death and its effect on Hadwin. Both belong to the gym. Pusilowski, who had recently started coaching there, was known for his humor, playlist, and rigorous workouts. After his death, there was a memorial class in his honor, and his personal best with the power clean lift, 165 pounds, is still on the whiteboard. He always pushed incredibly hard in his own workouts because he was striving for more, Gudez says. We all miss him so much. Hadwin and Pusilowski both attended Stevens Institute of Technology in Hoboken, New Jersey, and met on a school-sponsored ski trip to Sugarloaf Mountain in Maine during their sophomore year in 2017. They started dating in their senior year and had been together since then. He works as a software engineer for Disney Streaming Services. She is a systems engineer at Medtronic, a medical technology company, where co-workers have been very supportive, she said. Hadwin also played varsity tennis in college and said running was never her favorite sport. We first talked in person in early February, and her email exchanges after that, she shared the ups and downs of her training. On Saturday before Super Bowl Sunday, she ran a full marathon in a snowstorm. On February 15th, she attended the wedding of friends for whom Pusilowski was supposed to be one of the groomsmen. Part of the sidewalk was icy and snowy, and I kept slipping. I kept putting one foot in front of the other and eventually got to 16 miles. It was one of the hardest things I've ever done, but I was able to stay on track for marathon training. Hadwin said that the gym community has helped her stay strong. Whether it's taking me out for dinner, cat-sitting when I'm out of town, or hugging me on my bad days, they've been there with me through it all, and I wouldn't be able to cross the finish line without them. As she looks towards the marathon, she's not running away from the love or the memories or the person she was with Pusilowski. She was running towards the person she must be without him. This was written by Joan Benocci, a Globe columnist. That's all the time we have for today. Thank you for listening to the Talking Information Center. I'm Pam.
I'm Pamela. Have a great weekend.